So let's get started. So I just want to thank everyone today for joining us for this first episode of What Matters. We created What Matters to be a salve and a safe place for us, an opportunity to tell our stories, to amplify our voices, and to imagine and create solutions to transform our communities. During this series, you will hear from amazing people, experts, BLM organizers, brilliant people, notables, electeds, all types. Today, we're joined by one such brilliant person, Mark Lamont Hill. You know him from BET, from CNN, and as professor at Temple University. Thanks so much, Mark, for joining us. Today, we're going to have a conversation about this COVID moment, about how it's affecting us and our communities, and about a lot of the messages that we're hearing and how to decipher between misinformation and disinformation and just kind of just talk and react to what we're seeing right now in the media, and no better person to have that conversation with than you. So thanks again for joining us for this first episode of What Matters. And just first, how are you doing? How's your family doing during this time?
I'm excited to be here. And of course, I admire the work that you do and that so many others do to keep Black freedom at the forefront. I'm okay. You know, it's a tough time. Things are tougher than I could have ever imagined they would be even 60 days ago. You know, right now everyone is safe, which is a great start. In February, my father was taken to the hospital, and he wasn't doing very well. We met with doctors, and they weren't optimistic. We met with the palliative team, which is sort of the team you meet with at, you know, sort of the latter stages of life. And we met with the hospice team, and we were just trying to figure out what to do. We hadn't given up hope, but we were uncertain. And pushing back against doctors and doing that dance you do, anyone who's taking care of an elderly parent, my father's 92, you're doing that dance with doctors. And then COVID hits. And I can no longer see him. All visitations are shut down immediately. My father's battling an infection. He's not eating. The doctors take his not eating as a sign that he doesn't live anymore. We don't necessarily agree. I'm going to the hospital. My brothers are going to the hospital every day to feed him, to get him, you know, until he gets up and strong again. And then suddenly, you know, that week, suddenly we can't visit anymore. We can't see him anymore. And now we have to hope that he's getting the proper care. We have to hope that people are going to make him eat that extra meal that he wasn't inclined to eat. We're hoping all these things happen. It's hard to get into doctors. It's hard to talk to nurses. The whole nine.
Yeah.
Then we get a call later saying, oh, well, he's discharged.
Mm.
And he's in the nursing home. And we see him almost every day. One of us sees him every day. But the nursing home is now shut down.
Mm.
On the one hand, it's okay because you don't want people to come in and make the nursing homes. We've seen what happens when nursing homes get COVID, right? It spreads. It's very dangerous.
And we can't
die that way. Well, on the other hand, now, here I am now, almost week seven of not seeing him, you know, and we're all like hoping, one, that he's hoping he survives the initial illness, hoping he doesn't get COVID, which would be a death sentence for so many people at this age.
Right.
And hoping that we haven't seen him for the last time because we can't get in and there's no end in sight. So dealing with that in the midst of everything else has been a challenge for me and the rest of my family, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
But I compare that to what I've seen, you know, with other friends. My best friend lost his grandfather. You know, his father just got off a ventilator yesterday. You know, I'm watching people lose two and three generations of family members. I'm watching people not be able to. So against the backdrop of that, I say I'm doing as well as I can be.
Right, yeah.
I'm really upset for those out there who are doing much worse and with fewer resources to manage that.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing your story and that, and I'm so sorry to hear what's going on in your family. As you said, it's happening with so many of us. We're struggling out here. We hear about how this virus is affecting Black people disproportionately. Well, we heard about it, you know, for a minute. And then we hear other things. So part of, you know, what is confusing for many of us is the different information that we're hearing, information that's correct, that's incorrect. When we're struggling, we're looking for resources, we want to tell our story, we need people to understand what's happening in our communities, to ourselves, to our families and our lives. And we're faced with a lot of information that's either not relevant or damaging in many ways. And I wanted to get your take on, we're seeing a lot of stuff right now in the media about these protests that are going on, these anti-quarantine folks that are out there with the signs and the arms. And I just wanted to get your take on that. Like, how damaging is that for us to be seeing?
Yeah, I think there's two streams here. There's, of course, misinformation and bad information, right? Which is incredibly dangerous. And we just don't know a lot about COVID-19.
Right.
And that's from the top down, whatever the top is, the White House, whomever, right? We just don't know a lot. And so some of it is information that we think is true that simply is not true.
Right, right.
And the World Health Organization just last week said that, you know, it has not been proven that having COVID-19 means that you won't get it again. Doesn't mean you will, but they're saying there's no, we're just assuming that you won't based on how the flu operates, but maybe it doesn't operate the way the flu operates. Could it be something like chickenpox that you get once, you don't get again? Could it be something like herpes that you get and it may not always show up, but it's always there and there's, you know, and it can still be passed. So is it something like that? Is it something that you get rid of? Is it you put antibodies to? And is it like more like the flu? Is it more like, you know, we don't know.
Right. And
part of the problem is in this 24-hour cable news cycle where it's more important to say it first than to say it correctly.
Yep, you said it.
That's a very dangerous thing. And so everybody's rushing out to get information out. And so that's dangerous. And people just start saying things that aren't necessarily true. And it's extreme danger to people. You know, we don't know how long this stuff stays in the air exactly. We don't know how long it stays on surfaces exactly. We don't know, the idea of saying, well, after 14 days, I'll be good. We're seeing that contradicted by folk who a month later are still sick or who are still passing it to folk. We've seen people do two rounds of COVID. And now, again, there's doubts about whether or not they ever got rid of it. I mean, we don't know. I think the biggest thing we can come away with is we don't know a lot. And we have to move past this place of certainty and say, look, we don't know everything we need to know. And because we don't know everything we need to know, we can't continue to make public policy
right
from a long term that's based on that. For example, this idea of herd immunity, the idea that, once we all get it, we'll be fine. Because once we all get it, we'll all be immune to it. Or only small numbers of people will die from it or be seriously affected by it. It'll be like the flu. But herd immunity, again, is contingent on the fact that once we get it, we'll be okay.
Yeah. What is herd immunity? What's herd immunity? Describe that.
Was that if people said, well, you know, ultimately this won't go away. It's not like SARS and then it kind of just disappeared.
Right.
But that the way for people to get, what it means is that for us as a community, if the bulk of us get it, are affected by it at some point, then that's the only way we'll get over it. Because then until there's something to cure it, right? Then what we'll do is once we all get it, or at least a sizable portion of us, then we'll be able to move on with our lives because we'll have the antibodies for it. You know, we won't be constantly passing. We won't be in a state of crisis. The hospitals won't be overrun because most people have already had it or experienced it. And then by the time we come up with a shot for it or something to prevent people from getting it, which at least 11 months away from, could be 16 months according to science.
Yeah, that's what they're saying. And it's scary though to think about herd immunity in going down that road in the Black community in particular, because it affects us differently. So if we get this disease, many of us have underlying conditions that stem from health inequalities that have plagued us for decades upon decades. And so as a result, many of us don't have health care to be able to run into our doctor's office and feel, you know, like we're being treated for whatever symptoms that we're experiencing. So it's hard to imagine a world in which herd immunity is the solution, because it's essentially putting us at risk. We live in multi-generational homes where our grandparents live with us and are around the kids. I mean, it's just, it's frightening to imagine us and our communities focusing on that as a solution.
Right, I mean, any analysis we have of the situation, any solution we come up with has to take seriously issues of power and to relationships of power. You know, how does this affect poor people differently? How does this affect people in rural communities versus cities? How does this affect people in heavily populated cities versus, you know, less densely populated ones? I mean, all of these are questions we have to ask and answer. And the truth is, we don't have a whole lot of answers yet. Because of that, again, I think we need to pause and not immediately rush to get things, quote unquote, back to normal, which is the phrase. Yeah. The problem is, if our end goal of normalcy is really just to revive capitalism, it's just to make sure that the rich stay rich and the wealthy stay wealthier, if it's really just to get an exploitative economy kickstarted again, then people become disposable. Whenever you're talking about capitalism, you're talking about a system by which the vulnerable artists, right? Some people are rendered, as I wrote about, nobody. Right. And those are the, you know, they say you to make an omelet, you have to break a few eggs. Poor people become those eggs.
Right.
Homeless people become those eggs. Immunocompromised people of many sorts become those eggs. And so we have to reimagine that. So it's about correcting misinformation. Right. Think about very strategically placed information that is designed to not merely, that isn't merely wrongheaded. You know, we all make mistakes. But then there are also campaigns of information that are deliberately intended to back us, to give us bad information, or to get us to advance a political agenda.
Right, yeah. Yeah, and I definitely want to get into that deeply. I also want to think about what types of misinformation. So people hear that, well, this is not new. We heard about misinformation, disinformation, you know, with the impeachments, we heard about that. But people, you know, we're 85% of people are faced with misinformation and disinformation. We don't even know what it is or what it means. And I think about things like watching these mayors and governors who are opening up their cities that are, you know, against all scientific evidence, and they're being amplified on this national platform, and it's sending up, it's pirating messages to us. Or those protesters, like I said, those are pirating messages to us. Is that misinformation? Is that disinformation? Like, how do we navigate what we're seeing and really pertain it to our lives to help us to get the provisions and protections that we need to advocate for those to, you know.
It's a little bit of both. I mean, you know, you're watching complete chaos at the national and often state and local levels. We've set a bar for leadership so low that, you know, Donald Trump obviously looks like he has no idea what he's doing. And then when someone shows even reasonably competent leadership, we act as if, you know, they're the next great statesman of America. You know, and because we set the bar so low, we have to raise that bar and ask different questions. Because to your point, you have people in places like Florida, Georgia, you know, talking about opening back up the state or opening back up the city or opening back up the region. And these are and they often will say things like, "I didn't know." And then they'll name something very specific about this illness that we've known for months.
Right.
For example, being asymptomatic and being able to carry it and being able to give, you know, these are things that you should know. This isn't new information.
Right.
I heard one of Trump's advisors talk about COVID-19 and say, you know, we've had 18 other versions of this. And it's like, well, no, COVID-19 isn't the 19th version of COVID. It stands for coronavirus disease 2019. But the fact that you're in a policy conversation, that you're in the mix talking about this stuff, and you don't know the most basic dimensions of this disease is scary. You know, but again, everyone has their own agenda. If you're in the South and your voting base is largely comprised of people who use words like liberty and freedom in very particular ways that have nothing to do with justice. And simply have to do with the ability to do what you want to do. God, you know, who cares about everybody else? And so liberty, and it just becomes about your ability to go get a haircut or a tattoo, even if it kills your grandmother, or my grandmother, more likely.
Yeah.
Right? Then if you're in that kind of a state, then you're just going to say, I'll open it up. Right? So the governor of Georgia is saying, yeah, we're going to open the state. Beauty salons, barbershops, tattoo parlors, the least essential things. Who needs to get a tattoo right now? Right? I mean, I got lots of them. But I don't need one right
now.
Hey, right? But then you call the governor's office of Georgia. Right.
Yes, I did that. Mm-hmm.
And they're like, we're closed because it's unsafe. Oh, yeah. We're closed. We don't do tours. It's not safe to be outside. Well, if it's not safe to be outside, how's it safe to go to a hairdresser?
How you got me going to get my nails done, right?
Mm-hmm. And so at that level, it's not just a question of bad information, although they have bad information. They're just not well informed. We're in a moment where the president simply isn't particularly intelligent. I'm not saying he's dumb, but he's not particularly intelligent, certainly not like his predecessors. And he's not particularly curious.
Right.
And he's not particularly open to listening to other people. That's always a problem, but when you're dealing with a global health crisis, it's particularly dangerous. And so he's saying things like, well, I can do what I want. I can tell the states what to do, which obviously is not constitutional or legal. But on the other hand, when things start to look bad, he says, oh, well, yeah, I don't want Georgia to open up, but they're doing it on their own. I think they shouldn't, but I'm going to let them do whatever they want, even though I could stop them if I wanted to, right? So it's all these mixed messages so that he doesn't have to take blame for what he's doing, but he gets to reap all the benefits of the political gains that come from a Republican red state governor opening up the state.
Right. Yeah. It's very difficult for us to see all of these different messages and to navigate what's real and what isn't. And to see, when I see the protesters, it makes me feel like it's like everybody, it's anybody who voted for Trump, when in fact it's a handful of people. It's militants, it's white supremacists, it's anti-vaxxers, it's people who are fringe. You know, that's what we're seeing. We're seeing all that trumped up, and not, no pun intended. And it's really being this, and it's confusing. It's just like, how am I supposed to feel? And it's very difficult. And we also hear about, you know, folks on social media, and they're literally seeing ads and trolls and international agents creating advertisements and messaging that are just straight lies. Yeah. They're just untrue. And, you know, like Black people couldn't get COVID. Like, that was a thing. People said this. Right, and right. It's like, you know, when our social platforms are, when watch groups and advocacy groups flag these things, and when our social platforms don't correct what these mistakes or these lies that are being told to us, you know, after fact checking, when that doesn't happen, and we walk around carrying these mixed messages or wrong messages, what do we do? You know, how do we navigate that? Where do we go? How do we navigate the message that we receive to in this moment, where, as you said, it is dire, it is critical, it is not a joke, but where we need the truth? How do we find it, and where do we go, and what can others do to make sure that we're getting the right messages?
It's a great question, and part of it comes down to first acknowledging that this is deliberate, some of this, right? That this is people who have bad information. Again, we all made suggestions or ran with information we got that may have been not 100% at a given moment, right? And new information is coming out every day. Like I said, the World Health Organization just made this declaration a few days ago. And so we when you get new information, you use it. That's okay. But everybody doesn't operate in good faith.
Right.
So when we begin to see people keep saying, oh, this is just the flu, even after every major health official said, this ain't the flu.
Right.
And you start to see people who are prominently positioned in social media say, oh, it's still just the flu. Or you watch certain news networks continue to say, oh, it's just the flu. Now you have to ask yourself, what is their investment in minimizing this crisis or pretending that they never minimize this crisis? Mm-hmm. Necessarily about a global conspiracy. I don't think it's always that deep, but it's just as complicated and just as dangerous. Oftentimes, people are just advancing their political interests. And Donald Trump has a stake in saying that this isn't anything more than a normal thing, right? That's what he had. That was he had an investment in that in January and February. And so, because Fox News often operates as his mouthpiece, there is then an advantage for them to make, right? And then where that becomes unsustainable because everybody's dying, right, or getting sick, or know someone who's sick or dying, right? Now all of a sudden we have to pivot and say, oh, we never said that. We've been on it from day one. And so those types of things are so once we understand that everybody's not operating in good faith, then we can start to analyze this differently. So when you look on the internet and you hear someone say, oh, Black people can't get COVID, you know, and we all you know, traffic in spaces, meaning that is to say, we all are on platforms where we hear this stuff.
Right.
decisions about whether we believe it or not. And some of us, we know it's not true. Some of us made some jokes. I ain't seen no black people get it yet. I'm an African guy yet. You know, I sort of made a joke like that at first, and I feel bad about it because I was like, obviously I was joking, but I see how that can be dangerous, right? Those types of campaigns aren't just a random person talking shit, right?
Right.
This is sometimes the people who deliberately want black people to think they don't get. If there are people having white nationalist marches, if there are people who on this very day are leading marches against gay people, against black people, against Jewish people, against women, against trans folk, like if that's the case, then we can't assume that there's also not an internet campaign to match the street campaign, you know, that is intended to turn resources away or turn the people themselves away from those resources. Mm-hmm. And so we have to be mindful of that. What does that mean? It means that we have to use our voices, those of us who are platformed and have prominent positions, whether it's on TV, whether it's in podcasts, whether it's in social media, we have to use it. Some people say, why are all these celebrities coming out and saying they got COVID? Are they just trying to get attention? I would say no. I actually appreciate it. And then again, that's not to say there's not a cynical read to this and that some people did want attention. But I appreciate it when people stood up and said they had COVID. When Idris Elba, you know, who is a marker of health and masculinity and virility and desire. People love them some Idris Elba, right?
We do.
Right. and I be hating, but you know. When he says he has coronavirus, now black people are like, oh, shit.
Right. That is a great point. You know, that image of that man who you think is impervious to anything, if he can get it.
Right. So now it's normalized, right? So you don't have to be just old. You don't have to be an infant. You don't have to be in bad shape. And you don't have to be non-black or a person of color, right? You can get it. So even that, and so you got him doing it. You got a couple other folk doing it, right?
Right.
You know, when we see those stories, right? When I hear the Scarface is still fighting, you know what I mean? That matters. You know? And so here in Philadelphia, a prominent pastor, Alan Waller, who pastors a mega church, does a lot of work in the community, modeled getting tested for his congregation.
Wow, that's amazing.
And it turns out he tested positive. He doesn't have any symptoms, but he tested positive. Again, that mattered, right? One, you need to do it. It let people know that that you can be asymptomatic and still get it. That's not some myth, because people are trying to make it sound like it's some myth.
Right.
All these things matter. So modeling, also pushing back against bad information with good information.
Right.
And that's super important. So when I'm on social media, I make sure to keep posting and retweeting that WHO article, that World Health Organization article, because I don't want people to just assume that because they've had it, that they'll be okay.
Right.
Or that because they know someone who's had it, they can just go over there and hang with them. We don't know. I'm just saying we don't know. And it's okay. And we have to establish what we know and what we don't know. Disputing, because I've been disputing and pushing back against certain public figures or quasi-public figures who are attempting to, you know, advance, again, this flu argument, or it's no big deal, let's get the economy started, you know, get a chance of dying in a car accident or a fire, all this dumb stuff that doesn't make any sense. I push back against that because people put a trust in us as leaders, and we have to push back against bad information or else we're complicit.
Right.
You know? And then it's okay to just say, I don't know. You know, to wait until you have something to say it. You know, I'm not a doctor. I'm not an epidemiologist. I'm not a scientist. I don't do this for a living. And so any information, all I can do as a researcher is get the best information that we have access to and distribute it to the people who need it the most. And if we do that, we can get somewhere. Just to pivot a little bit, because I think you raised something else that I think is important that I'm so glad you brought up, which is the structural stuff.
Right.
You know, we got to have a conversation and engage in thoughtful action with regard to the structural stuff, because even when you get past the information question, there's still this question of how do we end up in this circumstance, and how most vulnerable people once again end up in the most vulnerable circumstances, because we keep talking about corona as America loves to do in this race neutral, colorblind, absent class analysis fashion. And so we say things like, this is the great equalizer. No, it's not. HIV AIDS wasn't the great equalizer. 9/11 wasn't the great equalizer. None of these things are the great equalizer. Tragedies happen to everybody.
Right.
But we are differently impacted, right? 9/11 was an extraordinary tragedy to everybody, but the Patriot Act had a different impact on Muslims and on Arabs and on Desi folk and on Sikh brothers and sisters. I mean, it had a different impact. Again, everyone was impacted by this awful tragedy, but there was a different impact. HIV affects everybody, but every piece of evidence and data shows that, that urban areas, black men in particular in certain areas had a higher infection rate. Urban areas had a higher infection rate than rural areas at one point. I mean, there are all these kinds of subgroups that we have to look at to say, wait a minute. And when we look at corona, yes, we all can get it on the same subway, but who has access to the resources? Who has access? I mean, even the idea of quarantine, that's a rich idea. Self-isolate.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, I'm lucky enough to self-isolate. I live in Brooklyn and Philly. And I was in my place in Brooklyn, you know, writing and trying to do some stuff. Some real privileged stuff to be able to do. And I saw how crazy Brooklyn was. And I was like, yeah, I'm getting out of Brooklyn. I jumped on the train to Philly and came to my house in Philly and ain't been back to Brooklyn since. That's a privilege.
Yeah.
I can fill up my refrigerator and not have to go outside except minimum, right?
Yeah.
My classes online as a professor at Temple University. That's a privilege.
And it's important in this moment to take a minute to peel the onion. So we hear these things like, you know, all the things that you just named. Black folks we're at higher incidence of HIV. Black folks are getting COVID at disproportionately high numbers at 2 and 3 times our population share because of underlying conditions. And we talk about, you know, obesity and cardiovascular disease and all these things that we blame ourselves for. But what's important in this moment is to peel the onion and to understand why those things are happening in our communities, where that thread started, what was the catalyst of the reason why we are impacted the way we are impacted today? Because that hasn't changed. And if we go back to business as usual, like you said, if we go back to business as usual, we will have the same outcome. This will happen again. This is not a surprise that a pandemic would impact our community the most. That is not a surprise because of what we have known and have fought for decades. This is just showcasing that, amplifying that, exacerbating that. So we can't just listen to it and just blame ourselves and figure, oh, well, maybe if we just, you know, maybe if my sugar, maybe if I don't eat that, drink that tea, it's real sweet. Like, it's not as simple as that. We need to peel the onion.
Oh, it's never that simple, you know? It's not to say that we can't be responsible, right? I mean, I don't know anyone who would say, you know, don't make healthy choices.
Right, of course, yes.
We all want healthy choices, you know? But what's the context in which those choices are made? What are the options that are available to people who make healthy choices?
That's right.
That's always the question. Kiese Layman, in his book, Heavy, talks about good love, healthy choices, and second chances, right? You need all three.
Right.
Well, right? Because good love, not just at the individual level in terms of the romantic or the sexual or the erotic, but also in terms of self-love, but also in terms of love in terms of justice, love from the state, right? Mm-hmm. And folks say justice is what love looks like in public, right? So that kind of love I'm talking about, right? If you don't have access to fairness and justice, then it's very hard to be successful, right? Healthy choices, right? Everybody should make a healthy choice. But it's much easier for me to get food if I live near a resource for food, right? If I don't live in a food insecure space, right? So you talk about my pre-existing condition. Well, I have a pre-existing condition because I live in a food desert.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I have a living wage. Mm-hmm. And I just don't have the resources to make these choices. But I can still make better choices. Again, it doesn't mean this isn't a narrative that somehow poor people and economically vulnerable people are just, they have to give up, it's a fait accompli, and they have no agency. No one's making that claim. Of course, you can always make a better choice.
Mm-hmm.
But information, it comes with political education, that comes with resources, it comes with an ethic of care from the state and from each other. No doubt about that. And then second chances, right? We all fuck up, right? We all make the bad choice. We all eat the wrong thing. We all do something illegal. We all do something wrong. The question is, do we have a safety net?
Yep.
And unfortunately, for poor people, we don't have the safety net. So let's shift that framework to this question of corona, right? The first thing is when you talk about, again, this good love framework, not just talking about good love at the level of the personal, but at the level of institutions, mm-hmm. right? Go to the hospital. We don't get the same response, right? It's harder for us to get access to prevent. And when we go to the emergency room, we have to have a pain level at 10 to get the same medicine as white folk at 5. Black women consistently don't get access to pain meds, to antidepressants, all these things, because this idea, which is, again, informed by histories of white supremacy and institutional racism, that black women can just handle more.
Oh, yes. I've heard that at the doctor's office. Oh, you're okay. You've dealt with it already. Yeah.
Happy. No better than anybody. Mm. So in that context, it's hard to deal with pre-existing conditions, right? But also, you know, what about obesity? What about high blood pressure? What about all these things? Again, where is the conversation about access to healthy food? Where is the conversation about community gardens, about subsidies, right? About rent control, the housing question. Because if housing continues to escalate, then I won't have access. And again, my place in Brooklyn has plenty of healthy food options. But, you know, I live in Fort Greene, and Fort Greene, the housing prices in Fort Greene have gone up 10 times over the last 20 years, probably more than that. And so, yeah, now there's a fresh grocer and a Whole Foods, which costs a whole check, and there's a community garden, and there's this and there's that. But the people who needed it the most back then, who were going to Albee Square Mall, can't get in it anymore. And then when I get to Brownsville, you know, I keep going further east New York, I can't find those things anymore. Mm-hmm. People are there. And yeah. So not giving people access to those things, or they come at a price so steep that you can't afford to pay your rent and get healthy food options. And you can't pay your rent in these neighborhoods because there's no what? Living wage. People are still making $7,000 to $8,000 an hour, even though rent's going up 10 times. So these are the factors that make pre-existing conditions tougher. Yeah, it's very simplistic to say, tell black people to stop eating that extra piece of fried chicken, or tell black people to not eat that extra slice of peach cobbler. I mean, yeah, there might be some value in not eating the extra slice of peach cobbler, but that can't be the story.
No. And that's what we want in this moment. We want to pivot to the conversation. We want to have that conversation. If we don't take this moment where we are told these things and we see these things and the haphazard data that we're receiving trickled in now and again is telling us these things, if we don't take this moment to address the bigger issue and advocate for the provisions and the protections that we need in this moment, we can't see it go back to the way it was. I mean, that's just the bottom line. It's enough. It's enough. And now we're dying again for something else, for another reason. Enough. Anyway, I wanted to also talk to you a bit about what are your thoughts around how this misinformation and disinformation is going to impact the election? So we're having an election. It's happening. It is the first week of November, first Tuesday, as it always is. It's constitutional. And so we have to vote in this new COVID moment. What are your thoughts about it?
Yeah, you know, I've always said we shouldn't romanticize or fetishize voting. It's not magical. It doesn't solve all of our problems, but it is a tactic. It's not the strategy, but it's a tactic, right? It's part of a broader strategy. And the stakes are so high right now. And we cannot afford to sit out an election, right? We never can afford to sit out an election.
Right.
So we have to make different strategic choices in each election on what we're going to do. But using our voice at this moment is so critical. One of the things, and I'm take the White House off the table just for a moment, not because it doesn't matter, because it's not the only thing that matters. Right here in the city, in my city, Philadelphia, but in lots of cities, determinations are being made on whether to open up or close the city right now. And by the way, the reason I keep using that in quotes is because this idea of cities exist whether capitalism is happening or not, whether businesses are open or not. And the idea of framing it as closing the city sounds as if it's something pejorative or negative happening, and opening the city somehow, again, it appeals to this very thin, narrow, immature notion of liberty. Right, I'm going to open things up. You're open. All you're doing is opening up a petri dish, right? So I don't use the language opening and closing, but the idea of what to do with the city, how to manage public works, how to manage public accommodations, how to navigate all these things are being determined by mayors. They're being determined by governors. You know, the bill passing through these bills about whether to give funding to small businesses, for example, in a state. This happens in state housing. And so if we're going to pay attention to these elections, we have to pay attention to the fact that over the last three decades, four decades now, Republicans have masterfully taken over state housing because we don't pay attention sometimes in off-year elections. And I don't mean black people, I just mean the electorate writ large. A lot of times we only think about the presidential elections, the Super Bowl, and so all these other years, we're letting people win city council seats and state house seats that then turn into bills and form other, you know, that in ordinances that prevent trans civs from being able to access bathrooms or prevent folks from being able to get computers in their schools or prevent the public library from being open or whatever the thing might be. And at this moment, we've seen so much evidence of that in this pandemic moment, of how states are using their power in ways that have been plotted out for decades. They didn't plan on a pandemic, but they knew that if they continued to build state power, they could control courts, they could control laws. And it's playing out right now in a way that they probably couldn't have anticipated. No one could plan on COVID-19, but what they could plan was moments where they could wield power. And then we get to the White House. Donald Trump,
right?
Probably the worst president this nation has ever seen. Even if you take partisanship off the table, because I could make an argument for Reagan having the worst impact on the vulnerable in terms of the ways he shrunk the government, the ways he expanded the military industrial complex. But in terms of actual statesmanship and leadership, this is the worst thing we've ever seen. On top of that, you have Trump, again, pushing, advancing policies that are of extraordinary detriment to us.
Yes.
So with that in mind, we need to launch a principled and pragmatic campaign against Donald Trump.
Yes.
Getting Donald Trump out of office has to be the biggest goal we have right now.
Yes. 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 And it's frightening to think the stakes were high before COVID, right? The stakes were high already when we thought about this election and we thought about how we were moving forward in this election and the reasons why Black people need to come out and vote. The stakes were already high. Now the stakes are even higher because the person in leadership is going to be the person that is going to carry this country through the remainder of this virus, hopefully short-lived, and the recovery. And it is going, that person is going to be not just a policymaker, but they will be a representative. They'll be a beacon. They'll be a North Star, a lighthouse for people to see that will make them feel better or worse, make them feel safe or unsafe, and make them feel like there's hope or feel hopeless. And that person and that role, and not to acknowledge all the other roles that you mentioned, because those are critical as well. Down ballot is very important. It is key to in our future to get that right. It's scary because of our quarantining. It's scary because we hear Fauci and others talk about how there'll be a second wave in the fall, and thinking about how we're actually going to do it. Not even the who, but the how. How are we going to vote? How are we going? Because we need to come out in droves. You know, we need to do 2008 and 2012 type numbers for this election, but how do we do it? It's scary to think about choosing. I think of Wisconsin and how folks had to choose between being and you know, going to the polls and their help, but Black people were there with masks on, standing in line, beautiful. But how do we protect ourselves? We shouldn't have to choose. How do we do this?
Yeah, I mean, we hope obviously to see a couple of things happen. One, we hope that the flattening turns into a precipitous drop in infection rates. We know there's going to be a resurgence. We know it's going to come. We just have to hope at that level that it happens after November, December, right?
Yeah, right.
That's not to say that it happening in December, January is better, because as the more it coincides with flu season, according to the experts, the more of a danger we're going to have, not just the people, but also to the hospital system's capacity to treat people. So I'm not saying it, but just with regard to the election, mm-hmm. I hope that COVID isn't spiking at the time of the election. That's one thing. We need massive absentee balloting, write-in balloting, mail balloting. That has to be our strategy going forward. And honestly, again, this just lays bare more problems in our system, right? It shouldn't be this hard to vote. You know, people shouldn't have to take off work to vote. How could it not be a national holiday to vote? If Columbus Day, right, an imperialist holiday, at this point, it gives us, why wouldn't voting, right? Because that would solve some of this stuff. Because then we could be more strategic about spacing things out. But if you only got 2 hours to get there on your, or 30 minutes on your lunch break, or you can do it before work or after work, and you work at 11 to 7, you know, you got kids, and, you know, it's challenging. So we need to make voting easier in general. But I think absentee balloting, write-in balloting, or have to be key strategies that we use right now more than ever. We need to organize groups to vote. You know, I tell people, don't just go vote. Go bring your people, right? Bring your people who are less inclined to stop what they're doing. They'll vote, but they're less inclined to do it. Obama gave people an energy. Obama gave people a sense of excitement and possibility. I was a critic of Obama. I remain one. But there was something about getting people out in record number because they had a thing to vote for. I think right now the challenge is people are largely voting against. I think when you have a Bernie Sanders, you have something to vote for. When you have Elizabeth Warren, you have something to vote for, right? I think with Joe Biden, the voting public is less excited about his platform, and certainly progressives are not excited by his platform. At best, we're getting people out to vote for, against Trump, rather. And so, but that hasn't always proven successful. John Kerry, you know, was the candidate who said, hey, vote for him. You'll be voting against Bush. You'll be voting against lies about weapons of mass destruction. You'll be voting against wealth, against weapons, against the illegal invasion and occupation of Iraq. You'll be voting against really bad stuff. And that doesn't always get people out. People need something to vote for. So I think what we need to do is let people look, the house is on fire. We got to put this thing out, i.e. we got to vote against Trump. But we also have to give people an affirmative vision of what we're voting for. And that's on the Biden campaign, but that's also on all of us to say, look, we know he ain't shit, right? We know that we are always voting for two bad options. You know what I mean? But in this moment, not all moments, but in this moment, as Baldwin told us, you know, we might just be using this process as a means of buying time.
Right, yeah.
A dime.
Yeah.
I think
and also to realize that when casting your vote is not the end of the story. It's not end game. You have to hold your policymakers and your electeds accountable after they're in office. Once they're in office, you have to hold them accountable for what they promise. You have to show them what is necessary. This is the way we can transform our communities. We have voices. We're important. We know what's going on. We can tell our electeds. We can make sure that folks know what is necessary in our communities and hold them accountable for it.
That's key.
Hold them accountable. But thank you so much, Mark. This has been an incredible conversation. Thank you. I can't thank you enough for being the first guest for What Matters. It's just been a phenomenal opportunity to talk to you, and hopefully we'll have more conversations going forward. Thanks again. My name is Kylie Scales. I'm the Managing Director of Black Lives Matter Global Network Foundation, and this was What Matters. Thanks, Mark.